alongside the dissolution of the Soviet Union as an independent political entity. The United States emerged as a dominant force on the global stage. It was a period that saw a significant push towards globalization as real socialism was coming to an end, creating a sense of euphoria that capitalism would be the solution to the world's problems. The term BRICS was coined by an economist from Morgan Stanley, who was impressed by the potential of China, Russia, India, and Brazil. South Africa had not yet joined. It was then that the name BRICS was created, which translates to a brick in English. This brick was meant to build something unexpected. There was a moment when the foreign ministers and General Assembly of the United Nations from the four countries came together to discuss how to establish an independent voice in international matters. They focused on various topics, including the design of international financial architecture, the roles of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the OECD, the United Nations, and international trade, as well as geopolitical aspects. Subsequently, they had several summits, one in South Africa and another in Russia. The most recent summit in Johannesburg in 2024 saw the BRICS group expand, welcoming Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Egypt. South Africa had joined earlier, around 2013 or 2014. This marks the emergence of a new generation of BRICS, now an expanded group.
Currently, the situation is quite diverse, especially from an economic and political perspective. So what's happening with the BRICS today? I see countries with political and even military conflicts with the United States are seeking to join the BRICS. For instance, Syria, Palestine, and recently Venezuela and Cuba have also expressed interest in joining. Does this contribute to a greater political uniformity, or is it more of a protective umbrella for nations striving for sovereignty and independence?
De paraguas y soporte para los países que buscan la soberanía y la independencia? Bueno, es una buena pregunta.
That's a great question. Indeed, the group itself has its differences. Brazil and India are quite distinct from China. And China is different from Russia as well as from South Africa. They each have their own histories and come from different continents. With the expansion to include new countries, there is potential for increased strength. I believe it'll depend on how the BRICS nations discuss their key agendas and what topics the expanded BRICS will bring to international discussions. These could range from issues of peace and wars in the Middle East and wars in the West Asia and Ukraine to more economic matters, such as finance and international migration. So it really hinges on how these agendas are shaped. Estimates suggest that this group could represent about 45% of the world's population, especially when you consider the populations of India, which has around 1.4 billion people, and China, with about 1.3 billion. That totals around 2.7 billion people just from those two countries.
Tenemos 2.700 millones de habitantes en solo los dos países. Así es.
Sure, over 45% of the global population indeed. Let's pause here for a moment and we'll be right back.
Perfect. Estamos de vuelta con André Solimano, y él nos estaba planteando.
We're back with Andrés Solimano, who pointed out that today the BRICS represent about 45% of the world's population. This is still developing, as over 40 countries have expressed interest in joining the BRICS. But Andrés, there are also economic aspects to consider. For instance, in hybrid hydrocarbons, they account for just over 50%, and in rare earths, they exceed 70%. This is significant, especially since Venezuela hasn't yet joined. Can you share with us the economic importance of this, considering that the BRICS have already surpassed the G7 in global GDP.
Claro, en el PBI mundial.
Sí, 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 en la participación del Producto Interno Bruto Mundial.
The global GDP is approximately 37%, with projections suggesting it could reach 40% and possibly exceed that of the G7. For instance, Brazil is known for its incredible biodiversity. It's a nation rich in natural resources and forests. Many countries possess abundant natural resources as well. Russia has a wealth of natural assets, while China stands out not only for its resources but also for its manufacturing strength, producing advanced products like solar panels, electric vehicles, and microprocessors. The core issue lies in the ongoing tension of the so-called trade or technology war with the United States and Europe. This was intensified during Trump's first term, and Biden has continued to raise tariffs and take similar actions. Additionally, we see the involvement of oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran. This group possesses significant economic potential and diversity. Their impact will largely depend on the rules governing the international economy and how the BRICS nation can assert their influence within existing organizations, such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the IMF, and the United Nations General Assembly and Security Council. While this is primarily a geopolitical matter, the UN also plays an economic role. Therefore, the institutionalization or integration of the expanded BRICS is crucial for effectively altering the rules of the game and enhancing the influence and power of the so-called Global South.
One of the key strategies among the BRICS nations is to trade using their own currencies, which is part of the broader policy of de-dollarization. This is particularly significant when dealing with sanctions imposed by the United States and Western Europe on BRICS countries like Russia, Iran, and even China itself. China is actively pursuing de-dollarization, especially based on the issue of bonds that the United States has. Meanwhile, Russia has shifted away from the dollar as a direct response to the sanctions it faces. How do you see the progress of moving beyond the U.S. dollar? Do you think this is a feasible goal in the medium term?
¿Cómo lo ves tú? ¿Factible en el mediano plazo? ¿Cómo estás?
Claro. A ver, si uno toma la historia como guía...
Sure. If you look at history as a reference, the most significant currency shift in the last 100 to 120 years was from the British pound sterling to the U.S. dollar. This change coincided with the decline of British dominance following World War I, while the United States emerged stronger, particularly after World War II. The transition to using dollars in various financial derivatives took about 20 to 30 years. While history can provide insights, it doesn't always predict the future. The euro has established itself but hasn't replaced the dollar as the leading currency. Many international transactions are conducted in euros and dollars, as well as in yen, yuan, and Swiss francs. Ultimately, the potential for currency substitution will depend on which currency can effectively replace the U.S. dollar, given the diverse group of countries involved.
Tenga más capacidad de sustituir, por ejemplo, al dólar norteamericano.
Ahí mismo, por ejemplo, el yuan chino.
Currently, the Chinese yuan has become the second most significant currency in the world, surpassing the euro. China is poised to establish a common currency among the BRICS nations, particularly as there is a vested interest in promoting the yuan.
Por cierto, con el yuan. Claro. Bueno, ese también es una interrogante importante, sí.
Well, it's an important question to consider why each country might aspire for its currency to be dominant beyond its geopolitical border. For instance, President Lula had a platform aimed at introducing a currency for Latin America, specifically in South America, which wasn't necessarily the real, but rather a new currency. Similarly, Russia has the ruble. I believe it'll also depend on how transactions between countries for oil, natural gas, and other commodities are conducted. If these transactions are carried out in currencies like yuan, rubles, Indian rupees, or Brazilian reals, then it suggests that instead of completely replacing one currency with another in all trade and financial flows, we might see a coexistence of multiple currencies. The BRICS has a national development bank located in Shanghai, and it was established under the leadership of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. They've made some progress on the topic of currency substitution from the perspective of the BRICS nations. Currently, if we look at the data, we can see a shift in currencies that have replaced the U.S. dollar in countries that aren't fully aligned with specific blocks, but are still significant in terms of currency. For instance, the Australian dollar plays a crucial role in international currency holdings, along with the Swedish krona and the Singapore dollar. It's important to approach this gradually and carefully.
Entonces, hay que ir bien, hay que ir calibrando a poco. Andrés, por ejemplo, 2019-2024.
André, for instance, from 2019 to 2024, we see a series of wars that encompass the entire planet. The BRICS nations at this moment don't have a clear identity like the Warsaw Pact or COMCON. But don't they already share a stronger political alignment, in a way, to confront Western Europe and the United States?
Política, por decir de alguna manera, para enfrentar Europa Occidental y Estados Unidos. Bueno, yo cuando conversamos de hacer esta de esta entrevista, esta conversación.
You know, I was thinking about our conversation regarding the interview, and I came up with an imperfect analogy related to the BRICS. It reminded me of the non-aligned movement from the 70s and 80s, which still has a presence today with the group of 77, including the Algerians. Leaders like Indira Gandhi, Nasser, and Fidel Castro were part of that movement, which gained significant influence during that time. In fact, it was discussed at the United Nations General Assembly, where the idea of a new international economic order was presented between 1974 and 1976, about 50 years ago. I believe that BRICS could also make a significant contribution by proposing a model similar to that new economic order, tailored to the realities of the third decade of the 21st century.
The non-aligned movement in the 21st century was quite heterogeneous, consisting of over 70 countries. Some of these nations had Communist Party leadership, while others did not. For instance, North Korea was represented by Kim Il-sung, and Cuba was led by Fidel Castro, among others.
Absolutely, Tito of Yugoslavia. Today, this must be viewed through different lenses, and the world has undergone significant changes over the past 50 years. I believe that there are many aspects that still need clarification. I would categorize them into geopolitical, economic, and developmental issues, as well as the critical topic of climate change, which is essential on the international agenda. Forming a group of countries is one thing, but developing and solidifying that agenda is another. I see this as a positive step towards establishing a more balanced international order, where no single superpower or group of nations dominate the rules, which often comes at the expense of the so-called global south, including regions like Latin America, Africa, and Asia. In that sense, I think there is a lot of potential in the BRICS.
En ese sentido, yo creo que tiene bastante potencial en los BRICS.
Because, for example, with the entry of Venezuela, which is proposed and will surely be accepted, it has a very powerful economic element because, with its vast hydrocarbon resources joining the BRICS, this move could have a major impact. To wrap up, my dear Andres, please touch on the political and economic importance of this development so we can stay on schedule.
I believe it's essential for Latin American country presence in BRICS beyond just Brazil. This could include nations like Cuba, Venezuela, Mexico, and others, as Cuba and Nicaragua have also expressed interest in joining. Argentina was part of the group, but President Billy stepped out. It seems Chile is not involved either. Having a strong Latin American representation in BRICS is crucial, especially considering the significance of energy resources like oil and natural gas, which provide a substantial advantage to the BRICS nation.
Natural le da una ventaja comparativa importante a los BRICS.
Así es.
You are absolutely right. However, time seems to slip away from us quickly, doesn't it? We have this situation from Chile where our country could greatly benefit from being part of the BRICS, and in turn, the BRICS would enhance Chile's sovereignty. Thank you, André, for joining us.
Eduardo.
Thank you, Eduardo.
It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Un gusto.
In the limelight. According to a new analysis, at least 10,000 more British children have fallen to poverty since Prime Minister Keir Starmer took office, thanks to the two-child benefit cap. We take a look at some of the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to new research, more than 9 million people in the United Kingdom experience levels of poverty and hunger so extreme that they're vulnerable to reliance on charity food banks. A report by the charity Trussell found Labour would fail to deliver its manifesto promise to remove the moral scar of food banks unless it tackled low household incomes in this group, which amounted to 1 in 7 of the population. The study found there were 1 million more people in what the report defined as hunger and hardship, living on income at least 25% below the relative poverty line than 5 years ago, and nearly 3 million more than there were 2 decades ago. Trussell said the rapid growth in recent years of households in this kind of deep poverty, meaning they regularly struggle to afford food, heating, clothing, and other everyday basics, had driven food bank use to record levels in Britain. The charity's chief executive, Emma Revy, said, "It's 2024 and we're facing historically high levels of food bank need. As a society, we cannot allow this to continue. We must not let food banks become the new norm." Children were at high risk of facing hunger and hardship, with a fifth of all United Kingdom youngsters falling into this category. A third of larger families, those with 3 or more children, were also at high risk of dependency on charity food. Trussell stopped short of calling for the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, to immediately abolish the two-child benefit limit at this month's autumn statement, despite its disproportionate impact on the finances and well-being of larger families. While the charity believes abolishing the two-child limit would cut child poverty levels in larger families, it would do little to immediately address the needs of most people at high risk of food bank use, including many disabled people and unpaid carers. Trussell's Director of Policy, Helen Barnard, said, "We know that removing the two-child limit would be a positive step for larger families, and we agree that it is a vital part of addressing this issue. But as indicated by this research, the majority of people who are facing hunger and hardship would not benefit from that one change alone." The Chancellor of the Exchequer is expected in the short term to resist pressure from poverty campaigners and backbench Labour MPs to abolish the two-child limit. The Treasury believes the £3 billion cost of abolishing the much-criticised Tory policy is now unaffordable, given the competing demands for investment across public services. The charity organisation Trussell says fixing the UK's outdated and stingy benefit system is vital to cutting food bank use, and as a first step has called on ministers to protect the income of 2.2 million people whose universal credit income is reduced by monthly deductions for historic loans and debts, and a further 120,000 households hit by the benefit cap. It says this can be achieved by introducing a legal minimum income floor under standard allowance for universal credit. This will restrict the amount that can be clawed back by the state each month. It also calls for uprating of housing benefit rates in line with rents and protection for disability benefits. The study found that most, or 58% of people facing hunger and hardship, were in a household where at least one person is working. Almost 4 in 10 people in households claiming universal credit were in hunger and hardship. Trussell, formerly known as the Trussell Trust, is Britain's biggest food bank network, with more than 1,400 food bank outlets throughout the country. Last year, it gave out a record 3.1 million food parcels. It has pledged to end the need for food banks, arguing they have no place in a so-called advanced society. Labour's 2024 election manifesto promised to end mass dependence on emergency food parcels, which it called a moral scar on British society. It also vowed to overhaul universal credit and introduce a strategy to tackle child poverty. Ian Porter, a senior policy advisor at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, said ministers who have promised to bring poverty down must see these findings as a sign that they can't afford to waste any more time and must take immediate action. The government has a moral obligation in their first budget to relieve the hardship which has become all too widespread in recent years. The website Nursery World has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to new analysis, at least 10,000 more children have fallen into poverty since Prime Minister Keir Starmer took office, thanks to the two-child benefit cap. The policy, which was introduced by George Osborne when he was Chancellor, means low-income parents are denied key benefits, including universal credit, for their third and any subsequent children born from April of 2017. The Labour government has so far resisted pressure to scrap the policy, with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, reluctant to take on the unfunded pledge without citing where the £3 billion annual cost would come from. However, the data from the Child Poverty Action Group lays bare the significant impact of the cap, showing 10,000 children have been pulled into poverty by the two-child benefit limit since the government took office in early July. The charity's chief executive, Alison Garnham, said the clock is ticking while child poverty rises and the two-child limit is the key driver of the increase. Scrapping it is the most cost-effective way to stop more kids being pulled into poverty under government's watch, adding, "We welcome the government's Child Poverty Task Force, but the damage grows every day. The policy must be abolished in the upcoming budget." John McDonnell, who was suspended from the Labour Party for backing a Scottish Nationalist Party amendment that called for the cap to be scrapped, said, "Many of us are pledging with the government to act on this before any more children are forced into poverty by this inequitous rule. No Labour government worthy of the name can stand by and witness children suffering and their lives blighted in this way." Rosie Duffield, who quit the Labour Party recently, said she would have rebelled to vote for the Scottish Nationalist Party amendment to scrap the two-child benefit cap in July, but had COVID. She said, "These new figures should shame every single Member of Parliament. We could and should do what all non-governmental organisations and charities have been asking us to do for the best part of a decade and scrap this heinous and punitive cap that traps children and families in poverty."
Thank you. the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
On October 29, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah appointed Naim Qassem as its new leader, succeeding Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, who led the organization for over 30 years. Nasrallah was martyred on September 27th during an Israeli airstrike that demolished several residential buildings in Beirut's southern suburbs. Sheikh Qassem assumes leadership in the wake of the recent martyrdom of Sayed Hashem Safieddine, a prominent Hezbollah figure initially seen as a potential successor to Nasrallah. Qassem's appointment comes at a time of heightened tensions and ongoing Israeli genocidal aggression against Lebanon, which has led to the loss of at least 2,500 lives. So his leadership marks a critical juncture for Hezbollah as it navigates this tumultuous period. In a statement, the group announced Hezbollah's Shura Council has agreed on the election of His Eminence Sheikh Naim Qassem as Secretary General of Hezbollah, entrusting him with the blessed banner on this journey. Sheikh Qassem became the first high-ranking Hezbollah official to deliver televised remarks following the assassination of Sayed Nasrallah, reaffirming the movement's commitment to continuing his legacy. Following Nasrallah's martyrdom, there were speculations that Hezbollah's Shura Council might delay appointing a new leader until after the conclusion of Israel's war against Lebanon. However, Qassem was chosen during the ongoing conflict, a critical moment that could significantly influence the group's future. A prominent figure within Hezbollah, Qassem has frequently engaged with the media and authored several books about the organization. His 2005 book, Hezbollah, The Story from Within, offers a unique insider's perspective on the history and operations of Hezbollah. This work is regarded as an essential resource for understanding the movement's background and evolution, and has been translated into several languages, including English. After the Israeli attack that led to Nasrallah's martyrdom, Sheikh Qasim emerged as the movement's public face, delivering multiple televised speeches aimed at reassuring supporters that Hezbollah's military capabilities remain robust and that the group is prepared for a prolonged struggle against Israel. Qasim was born in 1953 in Beirut to a family originating from Kfar Fila in southern Lebanon. He pursued a degree in chemistry at Lebanese University and went on to teach high school chemistry, including at a public school east of Beirut. In the mid-1970s, Qasim co-founded the Lebanese Union of Muslim Students and began his political career with Amal, a Shia political movement. Following the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, he played a pivotal role in the establishment of Hezbollah, which was formed in response to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. In 1991, Qasim was appointed Deputy Secretary General of Hezbollah by Nasrallah's predecessor, Abbas al-Mousawi, who was assassinated in an Israeli helicopter attack the following year. Qasim maintained this role under Nasrallah's leadership, where his responsibilities included overseeing Hezbollah's parliamentary activities as a member of the Shura Council. In 2018, during the Trump administration, Qasim was placed under sanctions by the U.S. Treasury Department, along with other members of the Shura Council, for acting for and on behalf of Hezbollah. Following the October 7th attacks, Qasim asserted that Hezbollah would not remain on the sidelines in Israel's genocidal campaign against people in Gaza and Lebanon, declaring that the group was fully ready to engage with the regime. On July 3, 2024, senior Hezbollah commander Mohammad Nasser was killed in an Israeli airstrike. Later that month, another Israeli strike resulted in the martyrdom of Fuad Shukr, a top commander and key associate of Hezbollah leader Nasrallah. In September, at the funeral for senior leader Ibrahim Aqil and Hezbollah member Mahmoud Hamad, both martyred in Israeli strikes, Qasim declared that the group had entered a new phase in its struggle against Israel, characterizing it as an open-ended battle of reckoning. Since Nasrallah's martyrdom, Qasim has delivered a number of televised addresses. In his speech on October the 8th, he stated that the armed group supported efforts to establish a ceasefire for Lebanon. On October 15th, while reiterating the need for a ceasefire, he remarked that given Israel's indiscriminate targeting of Lebanon, Hezbollah retained the right to strike anywhere within Israel. Qasim has emphasized that the group's fighters are determined to repel Israeli ground incursions even in the face of painful blows over the past weeks. Recently, Sheikh Qasim vowed that the resistance would thwart Israel's destructive actions, regain control, and restore order, expressing confidence that their cause would ultimately triumph. Despite its setbacks, Hezbollah has continued to launch rocket, missile, and drone attacks against Israel, and has put up a formidable fight against Israeli ground forces. The resistance group has just damaged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's home in Caesarea in a drone attack and said a new escalatory phase was coming. Sheikh Qasim has taken up the mantle previously held by martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah for over 30 years, reaffirming Hezbollah's commitment to its ongoing struggle. He has stated that the current actions of Hezbollah represent the bare minimum in their resistance efforts. While the battle against Israel is expected to be long and challenging, Qasim, at 71 years old, draws strength from the hard-won liberation of 2006, achieved against all odds in the face of formidable opposition. He firmly believes that the ultimate victor is the one who endures to the end. As a symbol of continuity for Hezbollah, Qasem embodies the movement's steadfast resolve and dedication to its core mission.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javed, as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we started discussing some of the jurisprudential laws concerning leadership or religious authorities in the past or from the last episode onwards, and we'd like to continue along the same line, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, if you will. Sheikh Javed, last time, near the end of the program, I asked you a question regarding the sources on which jurists or religious authorities and mujtahids, in fact, refer to or relies on in order to infer legal rulings. And you just outlined four of them for us, right?
Yes.
And unfortunately, due to the shortage of time, we couldn't actually, argue about them in length and properly. So would you please, again, enumerate them
sure.
and list them for us and also elaborate on each one of them?
Very good. Well, the Quran being the first and the most important source of derivation of Islamic laws, we do believe that the Quran that we read and that is available to Muslims is a non-distorted book. No religious authority from the Shia scholars has ever said that the present Quran, which is in the hands of Muslims, has been distorted or altered or tampered with. Yes, it is the Quran which we read and which is available in our homes is a non-distorted book, and Allah Almighty Himself has said that we will نَحْنُ نَزَلْنَا الذِّكْرُ وَإِنَّا لَهُ لَحَافِظُونَ. We are the protectors, God says. We are the protectors of the Quran, so no changes will take place in the Quran. So the Quran is a source of guidance, it is a source of light, and it is the most authoritative source for the derivation and inference of Islamic laws, the first one.
So you cannot find a Quran which is different, for example, in one country from another one,
yeah,
actually
right.
published in another country.
No matter how much they try to change the Quran and bring some verses of the Quran, they cannot challenge the verses of the Quran, the true and the verses of the Quran, and this is a challenge which is permanent, of course. Then we have the second most important source for the derivation of Islamic laws, and right. that is the Sunnah.
Mm-hmm.
The Sunnah includes the sayings, the practice of
yes.
the Holy Prophet, and even his silence. Silence means that when someone is doing something in the presence of the Holy Prophet and the Prophet is silent,
mm-hmm.
in fact, through his silence, he endorses and approves of the practice of that individual. When he does not criticize, mm-hmm. that means he approves of it.
I see.
So that's why. So even the Prophet's silence is authoritative for us.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to continue on this very subject of sunnah, in fact, yes. or prophets or prophetic way of life and conduct, right?
Yes.
Inshallah, after the break. Stay with us and don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on Iran Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chowdhury, guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws concerning religious authorities and marja'iyya or leadership with Sheikh Chowdhury. Sheikh Chowdhury, you were talking about the sources, in fact, on which jurists relies to infer legal rulings, and you came up to the second item, which was prophetic conduct or sunnah. You were explaining before the break.
So the Prophet's lifestyle or way of life is hujjah for us. We must follow the Prophet because the Prophet, وَمَا يَنْتِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ. The Prophet does not speak of his own desire and wishes. Whatever he speaks and whatever he utters is just the wahy, the revolution, yes. The revelation, okay? The revelation.
And this is one of the principal thought
yes.
or present and inherent in the Shiite school of thought, basically, of right? That we believe that the Prophet and the Imams would not actually follow their own whims and desires.
Yeah, of course.
They are only also inspired by God, revealed.
It's a verse of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
So as soon as Shias all believe that the Prophet does not speak of his own desire and wish, mm-hmm. okay?
Yes.
Whatever he speaks is the revelation wahy. So that's why we believe, and all Muslims believe, that the Sunnah is the second most authoritative. And then we go, because we need to be brief, of course the third important source for the derivation of Islamic laws, contrary to Ahl-Sunnah,
yes.
Is the aql or the human
reasoning.
Faculty of reason.
Yes.
Okay, the aql or reason, which has been translated either as intellect or reason or the faculty of reason. Anyhow, aql, whatever the judgment of the aql, or whatever judgment is passed by the human reason, is accepted by the wahy, by sharia, by Islamic sharia. Kullama hakama bihi al-aql hakama bihi shar. And the vice versa is also correct. Whatever the wahy or the sharia dictates is also accepted by the human faculty of reason. And when a judgment is made, passed by the human reason, and it goes against the explicit verses of the Holy Quran, then that judgment is invalid. But such a judgment is not passed, because as long as the human intellect is sound and is perfect and it functions well, it will not pass a wrong judgment. So the human intellect is the third main source for the derivation of Islamic laws, and then we have the consensus.
Okay, but let me stop you there actually for a short break, and also I want to ask you a question regarding aql or the faculty of human reasoning, but we have to actually postpone it to after the break. Thank you very much for listening. to your own program, Islamic Laws, on Iran Radio. Stay with us. We'll come back. Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Before the break, Sheikh Javid, we were speaking basically jurisprudential laws concerning marja'iyya and leadership in general, and the sources that jurists, religious authorities and mujtahid rely on in order to infer legal rulings in particular, and you reached the point where you actually advocated, about the intellect or logical reasoning,
yes,
of, human faculties, basically. And I wanted to ask you a question regarding this aql. What do you mean exactly by aql? Do you mean that the individual human reasoning, whether you're talking about, an ordinary person or a scientist or a religious authority thinking that, for example, this law should be laid down and applied, for example, to the society, or you're talking about a kind of collective reasoning of all the scientists or all the for example, religious authorities in this, situation that we are talking about.
Yeah. In my opinion, as far as I understand, it is the aql of the general public, okay? Because you as an individual...
You mean the common sense?
Yeah, common sense, yes. Let's say you as an individual know, with the help of your the faculty of reason that is embedded in you, that justice is good,
right.
Justice is good,
mm-hmm.
And then evil, injustice is bad. Every individual you talk to about the evilness of oppression, the evilness of injustice, he will come to know that it is evil.
Mm-hmm.
And no one differs in his opinion with you regarding the, for example, badness or meanness of lying, backbiting,
yes,
and these things. So it is the common sense that is a source of its authoritative and a source for the derivation of Islamic laws.
I see.
Yeah.
What is the last source, actually, that jurists rely on?
I'm afraid we are actually digressing a little bit.
Yes.
I should say that, the last source, which is of little and very insignificant value because of it is...
When you compare it with the Quran, for example.
Yeah, compared with the Quran, we see that ijma is also considered, according to Shia scholars and also even some Sunni scholars,
consensus.
That it is a source for the derivation of Islamic laws. Of course, ijma, there are different types of ijma, ijma manqul, ijma muhassal, and of course, all of the consensus, types of consensus, are not valid because it may happen that some scholars, some scholars may come to agree on a wrong thing, okay?
I see.
Only that type of consensus is valid which corresponds and which agrees with the verses of the Quran and with the prophetic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if a number of scholars agree on something which is false and something which is wrong, and it is transmitted down to us, passed over to us, we cannot accept it.
I see.
If it goes against the prophetic tradition and the Quranic verses.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on Iran Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to religious authorities and leadership. Thank you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Republican Donald Trump wins the U.S. presidential elections, defeating Democrat Kamala Harris. Any political combat following a hostile campaign? The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says tens of thousands of trained resistance forces are ready to confront Israeli aggression. And more Palestinians fall victim to relentless Israeli attacks on Gaza, where the total death toll tops 43,000. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has won the presidential elections again, defeating his Democratic rival Kamala Harris after a hard-fought campaign. The vote count is still underway, but Trump has secured 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the election. The vote tally for the popular vote also stands at 51% of the votes for Trump and 47.5% for Harris. Trump earlier declared victory over Harris after being projected to win the key battleground states of Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia. Meanwhile, the Republican Party has reclaimed control of the United States Senate, ending 2 years of Democratic leadership. Our correspondent Rachel Hamdoun is joining us from New York. Rachel, well, Donald Trump has won the election. Tell us what the mood is in the United States. And, of course, is there any possibility of any kind of post-election violence?
Yes, most of the nation was watching the vote count go through overnight. Right now, the mood overall, obviously for the Republicans so far, even on social media, Republican voters have taken in order to not only congratulate Donald Trump, but in order to also congratulate the nation and themselves for winning this. I mean, Donald Trump now is elected as the 47th U.S. president after he was the 45th. However, when we look at the Democrat side, I mean, there were a lot of people who were hoping that Democrat Kamala Harris would win, not only because she is a woman and a woman of color, but also because she was trying to sway their votes through the whole abortion matter. However, in this presidential election,